I'm Artie Moskowain. Welcome back to Radio Times. The armed anti-federal government protesters who call themselves Citizens for Constitutional Freedom are still occupying a building on the Malheur National Wildlife Refuge near Burns, Oregon. They took over the building this past weekend to protest the federal control of land, a long-standing dispute in the West. Their leader, Ammon Bundy, said their goal was to get the logger back to logging, the rancher back to ranching. He's a son of Cliven Bundy. You may remember him. He's the Nevada rancher who was involved in a standoff with the government over grazing rights that was in the news in 2014. Residents of Burns had protested the imprisonment of local ranchers Dwight and Stephen Hammond, serving time for setting fire to federal land that borders their ranch. Now, many of these same residents resent the actions of the militants. We begin our hour with a history of the fight over government lands, and we asked John Freemuth to join us. He teaches in the Boise State University Public Policy Department. He's a senior fellow at the Andrus Center of Public Policy, wrote a book called Islands Under Siege, National Parks and the Politics of External Threats. And John Freemuth, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Great to be with you, too.
Well, you know, I have to say, for those of us living on the East Coast, I think we have no idea how much land the government controls in the West. Can you give us the sense of the scope and scale of that?
It's pretty large. And the agency we're talking about here is probably an agency that you folks in the East have often not even heard of. But, for example, in Idaho, 60% of Idaho is, and I'd say not controlled, but managed by the federal government and various agencies. In Nevada, it's over 80%. In Utah, it's 60-some percent. Same for Alaska. These states in sort of the middle of the West, not so much California, Oregon, and Washington, they have high percentages, but not that high. But these sort of middle states like Idaho, Utah, Nevada, Arizona have very high percentages of federal land.
And is that because there just is so much open land or has been so much open land in the West?
Well, yeah, essentially you're right. You know, the two-second history of this is everybody's familiar with the national parks. You have them back there. You have some national forests, too, that I'm sure folks hunt and fish in and, yep, and do things like that. But out and wildlife refuge, but out here and only in the West, there is an agency called the Bureau of Land Management that manages over 270 million acres. And these are essentially the lands we used to say that nobody wanted. They tend to be desert lands. They're scenically spectacular often, if you like the desert. But they are the nation's largest landowner. And so this particular dust-up, as we call it out here in Oregon, is primarily about those lands that folks ranch on, very, very rich in mineral resources at times, those sorts of matters.
Well, I mentioned Cliven Bundy, and I think most people remember about that standoff.
Oh, yeah.
and having to do with grazing rights and the fact that he hadn't paid the government, I think, something like $1 million that he owed allow himself to graze his cattle on that land.
That's right.
When you talk about this land that's managed by the government, it's so people can graze their cattle, they can mine.
Mm-hmm.
They can also log on this land as well. So what's the issue here?
Well, the issue, and it put simply, is, you know, historically, and we always need to say and remember that Native Americans were on this land first before any of the rest of us. But essentially, after Native Americans were removed, oftentimes from their homeland, some of the early folks that came out there, because the land is very much suited for this, were ranchers who, you know, came out and began to ranch. And the higher country has a lot of timber. But over time, what's happened on the BLM lands is other folks have begun to find value in other things on those lands. They hunt, they fish, they recreate, they hike. Motorcycle use, what we call ORV use, is pretty heavy. And then we also have wildlife out there. The place where these guys hold up, ironically, isn't on BLM land. It's a national wildlife refuge, the Malheur. But as these other values have come, Endangered Species Act concerned, the ranching folks feel, and here I need to distinguish between the armed people at the refuge
right.
and most of the other folks out there, kind of feel squeezed that their activities aren't as important or favored anymore. And for folks back there, it's probably hard to understand how rural places like Burns, Oregon really is. There's nothing, there is no big city, and you folks back in Philadelphia are going to laugh. Boise's about 200,000 people, so we're hardly a big city.
Yes.
But we're the closest city to Burns, and we're 180 miles away.
So we're talking about land that has, I guess, many different uses. And is it, yes. as you said, it's not the government controlling it, but managing it.
Managing it,
and,
yes.
And even going back to this Hammond family that did have a ranch that's, you know, right next to this this National Wildlife Refuge. And there's a lot of complications about, you know, how they ended up in prison.
Yes.
But is it a matter of how the government then manages this land, the Endangered Species Act, all the other, I guess, regulations that go into effect on some of these lands?
I think you're exactly right. And the agencies have really worked hard in the last 10 or 15 years to work more effectively with all the different constituency groups. Sometimes these folks were, as you might imagine, went into this profession because they like open space, they like public service, they like to be outside. But they don't necessarily aren't always comfortable with the politics of all of it. They're much better at that. But yes, you're exactly right. They have to deal with all these demands in terms of what ought to be done on those lands, who ought to be favored, all those sorts of things. We just had a huge battle out here over the sage grouse, which is a wonderfully attractive but little bird, essentially, that we avoided an endangered species listing because a lot of people pulled together. But there's always been this kind of conflict over our public lands out here. The armed business we're reading about now, we've hardly ever seen that. We've seen a lot of passion, but not weapons.
Well, and I wonder, I don't like to make stereotypes about people, but I wonder whether people have been attracted to all that open land because they want to be left alone.
Oh, yeah, I think you're right about that. I mean, there's an element of that, and the great great writer Edward Abbey once said that the public lands are a place of freedom. I mean, you can literally be out in some of our desert country, and there won't be another person that you'll see or be around you for miles in every direction. It's sparse country. It's wonderfully beautiful again, but it's a different kind of beauty than folks maybe back east, unless they've been out here, are familiar with. And yeah, there's a lot of sense of I like it out here, just leave me alone. But even in the leaving alone, because those lands are so important to so many different people for so many reasons, you still have to be respectful of other people's interests and values.
Do a lot of people that live in this area, we've been talking about this part of Oregon, but other sort of open spaces in the West, end up working for the government?
Well, a lot of their activities historically were those things that the government must manage. The other thing that's misunderstood sometimes is when people talk about distant bureaucrats, that's sort of baloney. Forest Service, BLM, Park Service, I used to be a park ranger myself a long time ago, they're pretty much embedded in these local communities. There's a BLM office in Burns. It's not like these decisions are made in Washington, D.C. Those agencies are very decentralized in terms of being out on the ground.
You mentioned Indian tribes and, you know, who owned this land originally. I'm looking at something from the Associated Press. The leader of an American Indian tribe that regards an Oregon nature preserve as sacred issued a rebuke yesterday to the armed men. Obviously, if we're going to have a fight about land, especially out west, you know, how do you decide who the original owners are?
Well, I mean, there are, you know, and this is sort of an area, there are scholars, Native American activists and people who will all point out that there were multiple tribes out here, and they did fight over land as well. But the archaeological and historic records, you know, and the tribes' own mythology and stories, you can pretty well figure out who was out there initially because they're still there. This is what people don't understand is, they came back even if they were removed because that was their home. The Malheur Reservation, Wildlife Reservation Refuge, actually, works very closely, as I understand it, with the tribes to preserve their cultural history, their burial sites. And the tribes have, there's actually a funny cartoon now where you've got Bundy and his boys armed to the teeth saying we want our land back, and the next part of the cartoon is a Native American with the LOLOL, laughing out loud response, like,
ouch.
Yeah, if you really want your land back, how about us, So it's complicated, the story. There's many, many tribes out here with many, many overlapping boundaries and so forth and so on.
So is there a resolution to this conflict? I mean, on the surface, it's one kind of conflict. You dig a little deeper, and it's a whole series of other conflicts over land.
The only solution, I say sometimes that the public lands are a wonderful place to practice democracy. What tends to work, it's slow going, it's bloody, is getting everybody in the room, sitting down, trying to what we call collaborate over decisions that need to be made. Where should we graze? How do we, if we're going to mine, how do we do that? In the right way. What ought to be wilderness? In other words, trying to figure it out collectively rather than fight each other to try to win over somebody else. Because the person that doesn't win is not going to give up. They're going to keep fighting the issues.
And do you think, about a minute before I have to say goodbye to you, but do you think the officials will sort of sit this out or wait it out until this group decides? And it must be really cold up there, too.
I think they've learned a lot. See, the first Bundy thing said briefly was a collection of a perfect storm, new decision makers, bad communication. I think a lot was learned from that first one. And I think, I'm not a expert, but I think they're taking their time here. These guys are very isolated, and the community's turned against them.
And has there been thought that after the government took over or now manages so much of this land that eventually it would go back to the states or go back to private landowners?
Well, a lot of it did, okay? A lot of it was transferred. Yes, some people make the argument the state can do a better job. That's not provable. That's more of a myth. And privatize it, they've done that, but even ranchers get nervous when you talk about privatizing this land out there because they can't afford to buy it either. It's not good for a lot of things except what we're talking about right now.
Well, John Freeman, thank you so much for getting our conversation started today.
Oh, I'm pleased to do it. Everybody out there, have a good day.
You too. Teaches in the Boise State University Public Policy Department, also a senior fellow at the Andrus Center of Public Policy. And he wrote an award-winning book called Islands Under Siege, National Parks and the Politics of External Threats. And we are talking about the Bundy brothers and their supporters who took up arms. They are occupying a federally owned building in Harney County, Oregon. Stay with us. Much more after this very short break. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. It's been almost a week since the Bundy brothers and their supporters took up arms and occupied a federally owned building on a wildlife refuge in Harney County, Oregon, over an alleged dispute over land rights. The clash over who has ownership of large parts of the American West has a long history, as does the existence of anti-government self-styled militias. Joining us now is Stuart Wright, professor at Lamar University's Department of Sociology, Social Work, and Criminal Justice, an expert on religious and political movements, conflicts, and violence. He's got a new book called Storming Zion, Government Raids on Religious Communities. And Stuart Wright, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thank you. Nice to be here.
Nice to have you here. Also with us is Ryan Lentz, senior writer for the Southern Poverty Law Center's Intelligence Project and editor of the center's Hate Watch blog. And Ryan Lentz, nice to have you with us on Radio Times as well.
Thanks for having me.
Ryan, let me begin with you. This group calls itself Citizens for Constitutional Freedom. What do we know about them?
Well, we know that it's largely a rebranding of a set of people who were active about a year and a half ago in Nevada for a similar issue regarding Clive and Bundy. Eamon Bundy and Ryan Bundy, both of whom are in Oregon right now, are the sons of Clive and Bundy. And in many ways, what's happening there now is a continuation of a struggle that began a year and a half ago. It's a conglomeration of militia activists, anti-government extremists, and Bundy's own children who have called themselves this name in an effort to sort of organize around this issue in Oregon.
But what seems so different compared to 2014 and today is that these are now outsiders in this community in Oregon, and we don't see people coming to their assistance. What does that tell you?
Well, what it tells me is, I mean, it's not that uncommon for the Bundy family. In the year and a half since they arguably won their standoff with the federal government over the exact same issue, the Bundy, Ryan Bundy and Eamon Bundy have been traveling around the country pretty much as emissaries to this cause. They've appeared in Utah and elsewhere. And elsewhere in Oregon earlier this year, hoping to sort of invigorate a populace or a community with their ideas. In this particular instance, you're right. There is more discontent and disapproval from their own peers than before, and I think that's proving to be a little bit of a struggle for them.
Stuart, how do you see this group?
I would agree with Ryan. It has a brief history, but it goes back ideologically for decades. We saw this ideology welling up in the mid to late 80s with some smaller groups, and then in the wake of the federal conflicts at Ruby Ridge, Idaho, and right outside of Waco in 92 and 93, that sort of caught fire and I think generated a mass mobilization of these groups. And we saw an enormous increase in militia and patriot groups right up to and really the year after the Oklahoma City bombing.
What is their ideology? How should we understand that?
Well, some of it comes from what is called a posse comitatus doctrine. It's a pre-Civil War doctrine that the federal government doesn't have a lot of the authority and legitimacy it does to do taxing and take lands and so forth. And so some of that has been at the center of their ideology. But the government, most of the hostilities aimed at the federal government. In my book, Patriots, Politics, and Oklahoma City Bombing, I took this back all the way to the 1950s, and I saw the origins, or I'm arguing at least the origins of this, was in civil rights legislation and the civil rights movement beginning in the 50s, and a lot of the early anti-government hostility, animosity, was aimed at the federal government because of the passage of laws and the court decisions aimed at segregation, tearing down segregation.
So how do they feel about our president?
Well, it's no coincidence, I don't think, that the sharp increase in patriot and militia groups, although they had declined precipitously after 1996, a year after the Oklahoma City bombing, and almost bottomed out to just less than 100. Around 2008, after the election of President Obama, skyrocketed to over, I don't know, 1,200, 1,400. There are even more of these groups now than there were right up to the Oklahoma City bombing.
Ryan, you want to weigh in on that as well from
How
you track at the Southern Poverty Law Center?
Well, we track both anti-government and militia groups, and the numbers that are poised to come out have skyrocketed back up to just about 1,000. In the aftermath of President Obama's election, these numbers just continued to grow. The anti-government right saw him as a liberal gun-grabbing president who was out to counter everything that they stood for. Stuart is right. The numbers did plummet precipitously after the Oklahoma City bombing, largely because of crackdowns on these groups, infiltrations, and efforts to prosecute them. They seem to be coming back up, as the politics of this nation have polarized. The right and the left are distinctly different than, you know, there seems to be no middle ground. And so these groups have fallen in line behind a groundswell of populist, patriot, conservative support. And they don't seem to be falling at all.
Ryan, you mentioned the Cliven Bundy situation of 2014. Do you think because the government essentially backed off, as far as I know, they have not collected the $1 million that Cliven Bundy owes the U.S. government, that has emboldened some of these groups, or this group in particular?
Oh, without a doubt. You know, and in fact, I think it's important to look at what's happening in Oregon as a continuation of what happened in 2014. The figureheads of that movement in Oregon are Amon and Ryan Bundy, Cliven's sons. You know, and so in the aftermath of the federal government backing down in that standoff, giving the herd of cattle back to Cliven Bundy, and not making any efforts to collect the one plus million dollars that he owed, and that a U.S. district court had demanded he pay, they felt they had won. In the immediate aftermath of that standoff ending, a longtime militia leader named Mike Vanderbilt wrote a pretty excessive and lauding essay saying, you know, that there is no time, that courage is courageous, is what he said. And he lauded the people who had come to the Bundy Ranch, and these people are coming right back to the front in Oregon.
Well, Stuart, going back to you, you've written about Waco and some of these other conflicts and showdowns. Do you think the government is just much more cautious about taking on some of these groups for fear of bloodshed?
Yeah, I do. And actually, I would say that they're taking the right approach in Oregon, and I've said so a number of times in some previous interviews. Listen, they're isolated in eastern Oregon. There's virtually nothing out there. This is largely symbolic. So my advice, if I were to be called upon, would be to secure a perimeter, isolate them, let them face the cold. It's a very cold winter coming up. They're going to run out of food. They're going to run out of water. They're going to grow very fatigued. I would advise to use the same approach that the FBI used with the Montana Freeman incident in 1996. They waited 81 days. The group finally walked out and peaceably put down their arms. No one was injured. No one was killed. And that was in part in reaction to what they did wrong at Waco.
Well, and then arrest them, Stuart?
Certainly, yeah. Yeah, charges should be brought. But a rush with armed armies of paramilitary troops descending on this group would only inform them even more.
You want to weigh in on that, Ryan? And we've got a lot of people that want to join the conversation.
Well, I'm not a law enforcement officer, and so I would leave law enforcement strategy to law enforcement. But I would say that I would probably agree with Stuart, because what's happening right now is you've got, you know, the Bundy boys and their supporters taking over this wildlife refuge in the middle of nowhere. They've got snipers and sniper towers and heavily armed people waiting for a conflict. But the conflict has to come to them. Without law enforcement rushing in as they did in previous instances, the Bundys and their supporters just sit there and wait and look kind of foolish doing so.
And if they were ignored, I mean, if we weren't having this conversation along with CNN and everybody else, would they also go away?
Well, I don't know. No, clearly not, because they were ignored by the federal government 2 years ago. You know, the federal government just said, okay, we'll let you be. We won't try to make any effort to collect, to prosecute anybody for crimes committed during that standoff in Bunkerville, but also making no effort to enforce a district court order. I can think of no other American citizen that's granted such leniency.
Well, which raises, and this is has come up a number of times, which is that if these were a group of African Americans or a group of Muslims, would the government have the same approach? And I don't know if there's an answer to that particular question, but I'm Stuart Wright. It's out there, and people are saying, you know, why are these guys getting away with breaking the law and other people not?
Yeah, and that's a good question. There's no question that there's a kind of a white privilege that goes with these kinds of incidents. You're absolutely correct. If this was an African-American group or this was a Muslim group, I think they'd be treated differently. That's a very difficult issue here. I would just say that I would double down on what I said earlier. I think to send in an invading army, so to speak, and give the perception that this was another Waco would be a grave mistake. And I just think the FBI and the federal authorities have taken the right approach here. It's kind of a stand and wait and wait them out. And I think that's the correct path.
Ryan, if I could jump.
Yeah, please, go ahead.
Yeah, I mean, I think Stuart's absolutely right. I don't think that, you know, there does seem to be a certain white privilege in play here where the federal government, in regards to the Bundy boys, they're granting them definite leniency. If it was an extremist Muslim attack or something like that, there would be, as we've seen on CNN with the San Bernardino issue, you know, it was an extreme response, you know, an extremely appropriate response. But with the differing factors, though, you have to consider, there are no hostages. It's isolated and it's rural, so there's no threat of innocents being killed or harmed by the Bundys. In fact, they've just issued a series of demands and waited for the federal government to come. The federal government would probably it remains to be seen how this is going to end, but I think that it might fall victim to entropy more than anything else.
And that's Ryan Lentz, senior writer for the Southern Poverty Law Center's Intelligence Project, also editor of the center's Hate Watch blog. Also with us, Stuart Wright, professor at Lamar University's Department of Sociology, Social Work, and Criminal Justice, an authority on religious and political movements, conflicts, and violence. He worked with the defense team of Oklahoma City bomber Timothy McVeigh, and he's got several books, including Armageddon in Waco, Patriots, Politics, and the Oklahoma City Bombing, and a more recent one, Storming Zion, Government Raids on Religious Communities. 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. A lot of comments here at Radio Times at WHYY.org. And you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Let me get some callers in on the conversation. We have Karen from Wilmington, Delaware. Karen, go ahead. You're on the air.
Yeah, hi, Marty. I just have a number of questions regarding this situation. First of all, who, quote-unquote, owns this land? I understand that the federal government manages it, quote-unquote. And what is the goal of the protesters? Are they trying to have the land released for purchase so that they can buy it and add it to their holdings so that they can graze their cattle? And, I mean, I'm just confused about all that. And I would also like to add that, being an ethical vegetarian, I do resent the fact that the ranchers have essentially trashed much of the public land with their grazing that is so unnecessary.
Karen,
thank you.
Sure. No, I appreciate the call to Radio Times. Ryan, you mentioned the fact that there are a list of demands. What does this group want?
Well, the issue here is that, you know, the land is owned by the people, you know, by we the people, but it's managed by the federal government. And as such, the federal government has put in place a system of restrictions or policies that are meant to ensure longstanding viability of this land and to protect the environment and so on. What has happened more often than not is conspiracy theories tend to become infused in this argument that it's not just about this land being opened up for widespread public use without any control or check. It's that the federal government has introduced protected species to restrict the American public's access to it. That the conspiracy theories have gone so far as to say that the federal government has rented or given this land to the Chinese for solar farms. And so it just becomes this convoluted mix of policy that for someone who comes at it from a particularly conspiracy theory mind, a mind that's subject or susceptible to conspiracy theories, it becomes much more devious than simple conservation. And that's what we've seen with the Bundys. That's what we've seen in Nevada. And that's what we're seeing in Oregon now. If I can add one more thing and then I'll stop.
No, that's
the
okay.
The demands that they're asking for these lands to be opened up completely to the public, to use as they will. But as public lands, the federal government has a reason to protect them and to make sure that they're there for future generations. But that is not to say, lastly, that there may be a place for conversations about how best to use these lands. But as we've said here at the center, offering or bringing forth the possibility of violence to make that happen should never be the answer. And you can't suspend the rule of law just because someone has a gun and they're pointing it at you.
Stuart, are there religious overtones to, if not this group, some of these other groups that are so anti-federal government?
Well, there is a religious element to this incident in Oregon. Ammon Bundy, like his father in previous confrontations, says he's following directions from God. He evokes his family's faith, which is LDS faith, although the LDS Church has come out promptly and rejected any ties to him and says that this is not a church matter, right? But Bundy came out in an interview and said he'd prayed about the matter, and he was doing exactly what he was directed to do by God. So there is a religious element here, which is a little unnerving, because anytime you invoke religion in these kinds of matters, then you introduce the possibility that that violence can be justified morally. If you're fighting the enemies of God, if you've defined your enemy, be it the government or whatever, as the enemy of God or the Antichrist or the whatever, you've given yourself moral authority or some kind of moral grounding to carry out violence, because it's done in the name of God, or it's done to protect the faith community in defense of the faith, so to speak.
Stuart, I'm curious, since you were part of the or worked with the defense team for Timothy McVeigh, is he seen as some kind of a martyr slash hero for some of these groups?
I get conflicting responses there. I've certainly interviewed and talked to some patriot groups that see him as a martyr of sorts, and I know that McVeigh himself, when I interviewed him, he said he envisioned himself as maybe not in the immediate aftermath of Oklahoma City, but 20 or 30 or 40 years down the road, he really thought that he would be hailed as some kind of martyr or hero, because he challenged the Leviathan of big government and stood up against them and carried out this kind of vindication for what happened at Waco. He did see himself in that vein.
Well, let's take another short break, and then we'll get back to our conversation. That's Stuart Wright, professor at Lamar University's Department of Sociology, Social Work, and Criminal Justice. Also with us, Ryan Lentz, senior writer for the Southern Poverty Law Center's Intelligence Project, also editor of the center's Hate Watch blog. And we are talking about what's happening in Harney County, Oregon, militants taking over a federally owned building. Stay with us. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoen. We're talking about Citizens for Constitutional Freedom. That's the armed anti-federal government protesters who are occupying a building on the Malheur National Wildlife Refuge near Burns, Oregon. They took over that building about a week ago this past weekend. And again, our guests are Ryan Lentz from the Southern Poverty Law Center and also Stuart Wright from the Lamar University. And again, taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. Ryan, are we talking about terrorists?
Absolutely. I think there's been a reluctance on the part of the federal government to acknowledge politically motivated violence, the threat of violence from ideologically motivated people as terrorism, so long as it comes from white Christian Americans. The threat of violence to achieve a political aim or to achieve a political objective, that's by definition terrorism.
Well, and Stuart, my understanding is that people living in Burns, which I think is the closest town, is that schools are closed down. Many of the people in this region feeling rather nervous about what's going on. Can government officials essentially wait this out, knowing that there are people who are in some deep distress, even if they don't agree with some of what the government does, but deep distress over this group that has come into their region?
Yeah, it's an unsettling situation, but you have to weigh the costs and the benefits. And shutting down schools for a couple of weeks may be an inconvenience, but the alternative might be a whole lot worse. I noticed in one article I had come across that the The property near the Malheur National Wildlife Refuge is also part of the Paiute tribe's ancestral property, and they've come out and said, "Yeah, that
we'd like our land back, right?"
Yeah, which is interesting because they would have even a more significant claim to the property than the federal government would. But I'm sure that they share that and coordinate their interests there. So this demand for some kind of return to the people, so to speak, as the Bundys are claiming, seems somewhat ironic in that context.
Let me get Jim from Wilmington, Delaware, to join us. Jim, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi, yeah. Good morning.
Good morning.
This seems to have, you know, of course, this issue is related to so many other issues.
Pick one.
One of the big ones. Well, there's guns. The fact that the Supreme Court, you know, found a couple of years ago or so the Second Amendment gives individuals a right to carry guns.
Right.
And then you have people who just can't seem to wait to to do something extreme regarding guns. And so here you have people who have used an armed takeover of a federal facility. And I agree with your guess that the army or the police or shouldn't go storming in there and start shooting up the place. But when these people do get tired and it's time for them to lay down their arms and come out, I can't understand anything other than a really strong, long prison sentence for people like this. Why should they get away with this?
Well, I think there's an agreement. And one of our guests, I believe Stuart Wright, said that once they leave, they will be arrested. Stuart, you want to weigh in on that or add to that?
Yeah, I mean, the negotiators will play a very significant role here. So you would bring in negotiators and talk them down. And some of this could be even negotiated with them having some kind of legal defense. But with the understanding that they're not going to just walk out free, that there'll be charges brought, and if they walk out peacefully, then you've got reduced charges and maybe some consideration when the charges are levied. But it can be ended peacefully. You know, we've done it before. We've seen it before. It happened in Arkansas with the Covenant Sword and Arm of the Lord. It happened in Montana. It's happened before. It can happen again.
Ryan, to you, speaking about this group or even some of these other groups we've been talking about, do they want conflict? Do they want to, in a sense, almost like ISIS, you know, to lure the government in? Do they want to be arrested?
I don't think they want to be arrested, but I think they're definitely looking for a fight. And the conflict in this instance is you know, definitely one that they've invited. Eamon and Ryan Bundy, along with their father Clavin, should have been arrested a year and a half ago after they defied a U.S. federal court order, but they weren't. You know, and in fact, they've been allowed to run around the country in the 18 months, the 20 months since. You know, expanding this ideology, inviting supporters. And so what they found was that the federal government was really laissez-faire about dealing with them, you know. And so in this instance, you know, they're very much looking for a fight, you know. And so I don't think they, you know, however this ends, mm-hmm. I don't think they should be able to walk away freely.
Let me get Dan from Mount Airy to join our conversation. Hi, Dan. Go ahead. You're on the air.
How are you doing?
Okay.
I find that words, or at least in the arena of civil disobedience, might be what we could be talking about, because they're willing to go to jail to highlight an issue. They didn't take this place by force. Nobody was there. They walked in. They're gun owners. Big deal. They're going to go to jail. Nobody's talking about the issue that they're highlighting. They named their group after the Constitution. And you have a hate expert talking about, you know, obsessed over race.
If I can address that?
Yes, please. Go ahead, Ryan.
Yeah, I'm actually not a hate expert. I'm actually an expert on the anti-government movement. And in regards to, you know, questions or discussions about the Constitution. The Constitution is a fluid and organic document, not to be dictated by the, you know, by the demands of someone who's pointing a gun from a bell tower at a wildlife reserve in Oregon. So in regards to discussing what, you know, what might be valid or appropriate changes regarding the administration of public lands, I don't know why the Bundys with their rifles and their supporters should be the lone arbiters of what is allowed or not.
Well, and as I understand it, please go ahead, Stuart.
Yeah, can I weigh in here too?
This is not
a demonstration, a peaceful demonstration, even though they claim they're heavily armed. This is different than a group showing up in Seattle and demonstrating for environmental rights or what have you. They're heavily armed, and they've taken over a federal property. So I put that a little bit outside the normal arena of dissent.
Well, and again, as I understand it, there was a protest last weekend. Some of the locals protesting the treatment of some residents there who I understand are now back in prison. And these protesters seem to really resent the fact that these outsiders, I'll put this to you, Stuart, that these outsiders have kind of come into their area and taken over an issue that I think they feel very strongly about.
Yeah, I mean, you can't force yourselves on people who don't want to be protected. And the two individuals who were charged, they claim to be protecting or to speaking up for, have disavowed their activities and have said that they want nothing to do with this group. And they've already reported for, for prison, right? For their prison sentences that they were given. How does this group claim to speak up for others who don't want their who don't want their representation?
Go ahead, Ryan.
And I would add one more point about this. You know, like the suggestion that this is an act of civil disobedience kind of conjures images of people defying the law peacefully to change unjust law. I mean, these are not people sitting, you know, lying down for law enforcement to drag them out. These are people with guns saying, "Hey, come and take it. I dare you." In fact, that's one of the common mantras or credos of this movement that's kind of come about now. It's called Molon Labe, which is come and take it. It's sort of conjuring this Spartan image of we are Americans with guns, and I dare you to come try to grab it from us.
Hmm. You had mentioned conspiracies, Ryan. What role does Alex Jones play in all this?
Alex Jones is perhaps the loudest mouthpiece of conspiracy theories on the anti-government right. He has quite a sizable media network, and he is supportive of these causes. But what you'll see oftentimes is that the eagerness or the ambition to assign a conspiracy theory to this movement sometimes turns on itself. In fact, recently we've seen allegations or rumors that the infusing of this conspiracy theory into the discussion that this is actually a false flag operation, and that there are federal agents now in the mix up there who are leading this on. So it becomes kind of a confusing little mix. But Alex Jones is quite responsible for the spread of that idea.
A Facebook comment from Kathy. She says, why won't they turn off the water and electricity? Let them eat cake literally out of the snack machines until they run out of food. If the press is meeting them outside the compound, why not have a plainclothes officer just go up and cuff whoever is standing there talking to the press? Stuart, based on your experience, what do you think about that?
Well, the FBI is going to have to decide how they want to, how quickly they want to escalate this. I think they should secure the perimeter and not allow people in and out. Cutting off of the power has some other problems. The pipes are going to freeze. They're going to create some problems with the infrastructure there. But at some point, they may have to do that if this group isn't going to just willingly walk away. So we might see that kind of escalation. But I think that's within the realm of still a pretty good strategy.
Let me get Jeremy from Northern Liberties to join our conversation. Jeremy, go ahead. You're on the air.
Thank you, Marty. I have a question for Mr. Lentz.
Sure.
To what extent do veterans returning from recent conflicts play any role in the resurgent militia movements? And if they do, why do you think that is?
You want to take that, Ryan?
Sure, yeah. It's what we know that groups like the Oath Keepers recruit specifically from that pool, from former military and police officers. They believe in people who have taken the oath, and they want people like that in their midst. I think it's probably wrong to target returning veterans as being susceptible to this recruiting. A number of years ago, in 2009, the Department of Homeland Security sent out a warning saying that people should be on the lookout for veterans suffering from PTSD to, you know, be susceptible to this type of ideology or this type of lure. I think it's probably a mistake to target veterans. I think this is a political ideology. It has nothing to do with what someone did as a profession.
Thanks for the call, Jeremy. Let me see what Frank from Honeybrook has to say. Frank, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Oh, thank you for having me.
Sure.
I just was curious about the settlement in Nevada with Clive and Bundy. I thought the money he owed was put in a lien against his land so that when it's time to transfer the land to his sons or whatever, they won't be able to do that. At least there's some punishment there. I think the guy should be in jail myself. And I'm a veteran, and I'd like to see those guys, rounded up, put in jail. Just for what went on in Nevada, there were pictures of them pointing guns at federal officers. The whole thing makes me ill.
Well, Frank, no, I appreciate the call to Radio Times. And Stuart, we keep coming back to what happened in Nevada, but I do think it was an important standoff between this group and the federal government. You want to add anything to what Frank was just saying, Stuart?
Yeah, I'm not an attorney, so I don't know about the lien. That would be an interesting tactic. And it would be consistent with the idea that they decided to not escalate and walk away. And they had to. I mean, if you look at at some of those photos where the snipers were positioned around the area where that conflict took place, the federal government may have lost that particular battle. That would have been ill-advised to try to forcibly take the cattle, and I think they made the right decision there. And I don't think that's gone away, but I think that they're carefully considering their options, and I'm okay with that.
Ryan,
please. I was actually at that standoff on the day that it sort of culminated in that climactic release of the cattle, and I'd never heard anything about a lien. In fact, the federal government what precipitated or what prompted that entire issue was the federal government confiscating Clive and Bundy's herd of cattle as payment for that, for the grazing fees that he had failed to pay. So I'd never heard of the lien, and it would be interesting if that's true. But in fact, the cattle had always been the issue, because that whole standoff was compelled forward by the armed demand that the federal government release these cattle. And that's what they did, fearing, as they said in news releases, bloodshed.
Ryan, a couple minutes before I have to say goodbye, but do you think stressful, anxious, maybe angry times give rise to some of these militant groups, and especially these anti-government militant groups?
Yes. There's almost a direct corollary between the rise of a liberal president and the rise of these groups. Under Clinton, these groups skyrocketed. They fell under Bush. Under Obama, these groups have come back, and we'll see what happens in this next presidential cycle. But it's almost in many ways. Granted, we live in a time where left and right are 1,000 miles apart now. The culture is governed by polarities, but there seems to be a direct political correlation.
Do you see it that way, Stuart?
I would add that I think that these groups are encouraged by a very right-wing Republican Congress that seems to be taken over by the Tea Party, and so they see some encouragement and maybe some insiders or some allies actually in the government that would ironically encourage some of this anti-government activity.
Well, we could go on. So much more to talk about, but the clock is telling me we have to end our discussion. Stuart Wright, thank you for joining us today on Radio Times.
Sure.
Professor at Lamar University's Department of Sociology, Social Work, and Criminal Justice. He's written several books, including a new one called Storming Zion: Government Raids on Religious Communities. And he was worked with the defense team of Oklahoma City bomber Timothy McVeigh. Ryan Lenz, thank you very much for joining us on Radio Times
as
well.
Thank you.
Senior writer for the Southern Poverty Law Center's Intelligence Project and also editor of the center's Hate Watch blog. Go to whyy.org/radiotimes. You can find out much more about the program. In fact, we started a conversation about this very issue on our Facebook page. You can weigh in on that as well. Kevin Griffin, the engineer for today's edition of the show, produced by Debbie Builder, Emily Bryant, John Ahrens, and Liz Fiedler. I'm Marty Moscoen. Thank you so much for joining us.